Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey Griefsters, hope you're having an okay week. I'm having to record this under a duvet while in the next room my daughter watches Dr. Nortz. So if you can hear the strains of the Vegemals singing, or indeed Peso rescuing someone, or Captain Barnacles taking one to the HQ, I can only apologise. That is a lot of my life at the moment. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. If you do enjoy the show, please do rate and review and subscribe. It really does help other people find the show and is genuinely appreciated. This week I'm talking to writer and academic Sophie Ratcliffe, or I should say Dr. Sophie Ratcliffe, for she is an English professor at Oxford University, but she's also an author, and she's author of the very, very brilliant The Lost Properties of Love, which you will hear me banging on about in a minute, but I absolutely loved it. I think she's an incredible writer. It's not about grief entirely. It covers love, marriages, affairs, Anna Karenina, but I would recommend it very much if you lost a parent at a young age, because the way Sophie writes about that I found really touching and, yeah, just really hit home a lot. Sophie came in to talk to me about her dad, who died when she was 13. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with academic and writer Sophie Ratcliffe. Hello.
Hello.
Sophie is the author of The Lost Properties of Love, which is an incredible book. I loved it. I'm like looking at it embarrassed because I loved it so much. I don't want to directly stare at you as I say, I loved your book. That's out now in hardback. I don't even know what to be. The test of a book for me, Sophie, is how many pages I folded over for things I liked. And there's a lot.
It's looking reassuringly dogged.
It's reassuringly dogged. Yeah. And reassuringly, you know, when you're reading something, you're like, oh, that's good. Oh, that's good as well. And it was funny because when you sent it to me, it was sort of under the caveat of like, oh, it's not quite about grief. Mm. But it sort of is, even though I would say, unlike some of the books I get sent, it's not the direct, I guess the A storyline isn't like grief as such. But it's about loss, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's about love, death, trains and me.
Yeah.
And the central line really is it's a book about how childhood bereavement shapes a subsequent life.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what it turned out to be. It might not have been the book ages ago I thought I was going to write, because I think I've always in some ways tried to avoid talking or writing about my father's death, and I don't want to. I always thought I don't want to bore anyone with it.
Yeah,
you know, who will want to hear?
I think that's kind of interesting because I think that's one of the reasons I liked it. It's because it's so hidden within the text and then keeps bubbling up in the way that I think I very much relate to with childhood bereavement. So, I mean, you've said so. Who are we essentially remembering today? Because we're not. Don't worry, it's not. You haven't tuned into Open Book, sadly. As much as I'd love to do it.
We're remembering my father, Andrew Ratcliffe, who died in 1988 when I was 13 years old.
Wow. It's weird, isn't it, the way you feel connections? Like, because my dad died in 1998.
Whoa.
I was like, oh my God, this is 10 years before. And also, we're both North London gals.
Yeah.
So there was a hardcore mentioning of Brent Cross, which I really related to. Because Brent Cross is a shopping centre in North London. And if you don't live in North London, you won't have been there. But if you go up in North London, it's the highlight of your weekend is a trip to Brent Cross. And I loved how much it popped up in the book.
I wasn't expecting to write about Brent Cross, but then I also realised how central it was to, because, I mean, we both lost our fathers as teenagers.
Yeah,
and but it is that mecca where things happen. And, I mean, it was where my dad ended up taking me and ended up kind of being sick in, whereas he was kind of quite terminally ill. But it was a place of sort of Dazzle and Dorothy Perkins, CNA.
And I think you capture a time when we didn't have online shopping. And so like somewhere like Brent Cross was really like a real futuristic, cool place to be. You know, like they had all the shops in one place and it was covered. Like the idea of a shopping centre now, I think, sounds like, you know, someone in their 60s trying to explain like rationing or something. It sounds like really that was what you were dealing with. But
your Brent Cross might have been slightly different to my Brent Cross because I'm about a decade older than it. It was just Benetton. I just remember all those folded jumpers.
Yeah. I mean glamorous in like not a glamorous way, but I mean when you're of like 13, you're like, I went to Brent Cross and I bought some Levi jeans. Ergo, I'm a grown-up.
You got to buy Levi jeans.
I bought some Levi jeans.
I just got to look.
I saved up and bought some Levi jeans from Fenwick's.
With the great perfume ladies who used to spray.
The highlight of one trip was that me and my brother in the John Lewis restaurant, having our regular pancakes with whipped cream, which was the regular thing that we had, saw Simon Mayo, the radio DJ, in the restaurant, and we couldn't believe someone we'd seen on television was in Brent Cross.
That's super cool.
That was very cool. Anyway, I've gone right off topic. So what did Andrew die of? What did your dad die of?
He died of malignant melanoma, skin cancer, which he was diagnosed with when I was 3 years old.
Wow.
And the doctors, according to my mum, told her that he was going to die within the year, and they said you mustn't tell him.
What?
That's how terminal illness was handled, because it would. And so my father had this operation. His moles had been bleeding on and off for a while, and being a sort of get on with it kind of person, and there wasn't much publicity about skin cancer in those days.
Yeah.
And by the time he'd gone to the doctor, it had metastasized.
Wow.
But they operated, but they said he wasn't going to live, but mum mustn't tell him. And after about 2 weeks, she just realized that she could not tell him. He was so delighted that he thought he'd been cured. He was about to give massive amount of money we didn't have to the Royal Marsden Hospital to say thank you. He said, I'm going to give them the house. They saved my life. And mum had to tell him. But as it was, he lived for 10 years, but always with the knowledge
that he was dying.
That's so. Or that he was in kind of on-off remission.
Yeah. I still find, I know that did happen, and I've had other guests say that, like somebody wasn't told. I think yours is the latest, as in up to nine. You know, I've had guests from the 60s or 70s saying, the person wasn't told. So like not to be told, not told in 1988, it must be.
No,
like
he died in 1988, so he was not told.
He was diagnosed in 78.
So he was not told in 1978.
Of course.
Yes, it was inconceivable, but if you think back, this is the 70s.
So it's about the 80s, they decided to start telling people that they might be dying. But your poor mum, because imagine what she would have, how she would have felt with him being like, oh, everything's fine now.
Yes.
How could she have ever faked that? What wife could ever have been like, oh, yes, darling, okay?
No, it must have been unimaginably difficult.
Yeah,
Two little children.
So you had two kids. Your mum had two kids at that point.
At that point, yes.
And then they went on to have more children.
One more. So my sister was born in 1987, the year before my father died.
Wow. So they had a child when he was still in treatment again, or had he stopped treatment?
Stopped treatment, yeah.
God, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think at the time, maybe people were thinking, why would people do that? But you can quite understand why people
I can understand why you want to create life while you're still here.
Yeah.
You think, well, I'm still here. They didn't think I was going to be here.
And, I think the presence of my sister gave my father a huge amount of joy.
Oh, that's so nice. And he got to see her being born.
Yeah.
So when he was diagnosed, you were three. So I guess no one told you?
No.
What do you remember? Like, do you remember? I know in the book you talk about, like you said, to him throwing up in Brent Cross. Obviously, he was very sick. But do you remember much before that he was ill? Or
it was just. I suppose it was my normal.
Yeah.
I remember. Actually, it's interesting how many early memories surrounded the illness. Things I remember from my early childhood. Maybe some people remember. People often remember early birthday parties or significant holidays, but messed up in that in my mind, I do remember being on holiday in France and blood, which I think might have been something to do that. I remember the first operation. I remember how strange, because they had to do skin grafts over the mole. So I remember that. And there must have been a lot of coming and going and absence and parents not being there. And I think now children realise a lot. I remember just basically from early childhood being very, very scared of burglars.
Oh, yes, you write about that in the book. I really love this.
And I didn't sleep a lot of the time. I just wouldn't go to bed. Mm. So I used to refuse to go to bed. I mean, in such a fierce refusal, people might say, well, why didn't my parents just send me? But I would fiercely refuse and absolutely would, because I was so terrified. And then when my parents went to bed, I used to go and get in their bed, and then they refused it. So then I used to sit outside the door or on the landing to fit so that the burglars wouldn't get to me. So a lot of memories of trying, because I wasn't, I don't know, here's my cause effect. Yeah, I have a feeling that because I wasn't told, and this is not a sense of it should have been done differently.
Yeah, yeah.
How would you explain that? But I just got something, my child's have got a sense that
something's
deeply wrong.
Something is not okay and my family's at threat.
Yeah.
Because I guess that's what everyone's acting like. Your family's at threat and you're sensitive enough to pick up like, oh, we're in danger.
Yeah.
But I don't know why. And they say that, I mean, that's why they suggest telling kids now, isn't it? Because all the studies point out now that kids will invent a reason. They won't just go, oh, I don't know, so I'm not going to think about it. They'll be like, oh, I guess it's because we're deeply at threat of being burgled. So,
yes, because that's a narrative you've read about in a Richard Scarry book, that there's burglars that will come No, I've got a friend who's just got a couple of papers out about talking to children about kind of how to talk, and that advising health practitioners into when they're talking to people about terminal illness, would you like support in telling your children, which I think is really, really great.
Yeah, amazing, because I think it's difficult, I guess, it must have been difficult for your parents as well, because as you said, you're three when it begins. So, you know, that's a huge difference. And 13 when he dies, that's a person has changed significantly in that process. So your understanding of it must have grown as you grew. So as you got nearer 13, were you much more like, oh, my dad is not well?
Funny, actually, because physically, I think he might have gone in for one more operation. But other than that, one or two and lots of checkups. But really, I was not. I both knew he was sick and didn't know.
Yeah.
I can't quite wrap my head around how that can be possible. And until he actually, I asked a question and he told me the answer.
What did you say?
I was sitting in the back of. He used to take me to school by train, but intriguingly, he bought an old banger and started driving me to school. I wonder whether he wasn't so well. And he was driving me to school, and I was in the back of the car. Cars are really good for conversation, difficult conversations.
You have to directly look at someone, yeah.
And I said, what he was talking about work, his job, and I said, what exactly do you do. And he was telling me a bit more about it. And I said, do you like it? And he said, no. And I said, what would you like to do? He said, I'd like to be a travel writer. I'd like to go and travel places and write about them, and would really enjoy doing that. I said, well, why don't you do that? And he said, well, because I have an illness called cancer and I'm going to die. And I need to, I think he said, well, he certainly made, he gave me to understand that he was going to die. And he said, and the job that I do has something called insurance. And it means that you and your brother and mummy will be looked after. And I just remember, must have remembered that, because I just felt completely like, that's extraordinary that you're not doing what you want to do.
That's incredible that he spoke to you with that clarity. I think that's a real testament to, like, him as a person, that he didn't sugarcoat that.
No, he never did, actually. I remember he was, it's odd, but he wouldn't, but at the same time, he never after that ever had a conversation with me about, what is your life going to be like?
Wow.
So that was it. But he was very, very honest. I remember her kind of asking whether he could explain certain things about sort of, what do two men do in bed together if Gareth and Simon are friends? And he said, if you could pop upstairs, I'll have a think about that. And he'll come down. And he said, well, this is what I understand. So he's very, very honest about things. He was quite interested in technicalities. And so it was interesting. This conversation was very much X, Y, Z.
This is why I'm doing this. Yeah. So that you'll be okay. But that's interesting because I think, you know, especially in those days, I think some people would have changed the subject or just said, well, you know, daddy will go away and all of that. Yeah. But to be like, yeah, I'm doing this so that you guys can be okay. That's extraordinary. And what is that hard for you? I'm not suggesting you should, but of course, did you as a child feel guilty about that? Or did you just think, oh, that's nice?
No, I don't think I felt guilty because I could see that he was talking about the whole family, so I wasn't going. I just felt really, I felt really sad for him.
Yeah.
And I also think it provided one of the sort of legacies of early loss, which was I thought that really sucks. That's fucking awful. And I thought I'm going to make sure. Kind of that I do what I want with my life, not just to you've given me that. I better make a fair hash of it.
Yeah, and then funny that you've ended up being a writer. Do you think there was like not obviously who knows why things happen and all the reasons, but the fact that you've ended up making your life doing what he in a way wanted to do.
I think it's interesting. I very much decided as soon as I started to become aware, I must have been aware, as I was aware that he was ill, I decided I was going to be a doctor and I was going to find the cure for cancer.
That's very common, isn't it, with kids and cancer or kids and illness of like, right, okay. And often I get emails from people being like, I'm a doctor because literally I followed it right through.
it was a total sort of salvation. I can't cure him, but I'm going to make, but I read a poem at school after he died, and it sort of helped in a way that other things didn't. And I think it was quite a hedonistic decision in that sense of the lesson I got from that conversation was if pleasure is there, seize it, because there may be a time when you have to be very responsible and you can't. And so I think my decision to follow a life of words and books and writing was came from take the risk and seize it and do it.
That's a really it's very emotionally mature reaction to be like, because some would say like there's a hedonistic thing of like, oh, I've been close to death, so now I'm taking stupid risks. I know you write about this in the book as well, but I think the way you're putting it of like, no, have pleasure now because it might still happen. So you still have that element of death anxiety of like, oh, it might still happen, that's why I have to make my pleasure now.
Yeah.
Whereas I think sometimes the reaction of death anxiety can be like, oh, it's happening, so batten down the hatches, don't get too crazy, guys, like, because it's too scary.
Is it? I'm trying to think.
I just think about different people and my version of it, but I think there's a very, like, I think it's quite a wise and healthy attitude to be like, well, I'm going to seize pleasure now because responsibility might happen. So you're not someone who's like, I'm just going to do what I want because I'll just die tomorrow. It's not that attitude. It's quite practical.
I certainly, as a teenager, I had, I'm going to do what I want because I might die tomorrow.
Okay, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But the one that has grown into it is is certainly. And but I know that I'm always pushing back or fighting against a complete sort of just like a risk taking hedonism, which is sort of if a self forms quite early, which I sort of think a lot of our sort of psychic stuff is unfortunately fixed by what's happened. If I have a pathway, it is to go, oh right, there's a risk, let's take it. But also I do have, I much less so now, but I had quite a lot of hypochondria. I was very worried.
I still have that.
Do you?
Yeah, God, I still have to really talk myself down. Like that lump is this, that feeling is this. Like I have to, you know, I'm on the websites checking the symptoms.
Oh, you shouldn't go on the websites, Carrie.
No, I got, I'm very good. I go on the specific cancer websites. So I'm very careful just to see, so what are the symptoms of bowel cancer? Just so I know. And then I think, that doesn't sound like what you have. It sounds like you're tired. You're just tired. And then I'm like, okay. So I have it under control, I think. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely have hypochondria of a certain degree.
It's interesting. I think I was relieved to find I'm married to a doctor.
Nice.
That doctors too, not particularly my husband, but having talked to quite a lot of doctors sort of over the dinner table when they're relaxed, they too can
worry about these things.
Can be quite hypochondriac. So, and that also relieved me that it's not sort of it's normal. I mean, we're on scales.
It's quite natural.
I thought I kind of have multiple hypochondria. I'm now kind of thinking I'm the worst, most extreme hypochondriac in the world. It's just it's normal.
Yeah. I think it's just normal. I'm sure. Yeah, cave people must have been like, oh, my toe feels funny.
Oh, that would be a lovely sketch.
Yeah. Do I have that toe thing that Og died of last week because he stubbed his toe and he fell
over? I don't know what the cave equivalent of calling 111 and being on hold for ages.
Just walking for a long time to your friend who is good at herbs, probably.
Yeah, and then with a really long queue, and she goes through a long checklist.
So when he died, you talk about this in the book, but he went into a hospice in North London. So were you guys with him at the moment, or...?
No, he was in the Royal Free in London for a bit.
I love your description of, like, it meant you were able to go to Hampstead and Hampstead had a body shop. I just remember stuff like, because you're still a teenager and you're just like, oh, that's good, I can go there. Like,
I've got all my diaries. And it's just quite alarming that so it's page after page of kind of accounts of the disco that I might get to go to, and I'm going to wear the houndstooth miniskirt that I got at CNA, and then kind of half a sentence about my dad.
Yeah. But then it would be really weird if you found a 13-year-old's diaries that was like pages and pages of what does it mean when if my dad is sick, how am I going to deal with it? Yeah. Because one, you haven't crossed that border yet, so you don't know. You have no concept of what's happening to you. So it would be strange not to be filled with... I think that's testament to just the normality of it, that it's filled with discos and CNA and body shop. It's like, that's all that's in your head at 13, really.
Yeah, and writing it out. And the determination, because there's a frustration for teenagers who are dealing in caring roles. And if you are imminently bereaved or bereaved, you are also in a caring role, trying to sort of look after those around you. There's a frustration, like, I don't want to miss out. I still want to, kind of desperate for that first kiss, which kind of never seems to happen, standing there. So he was in the hospital, and then they moved him to a really lovely hospice. But it was still just awful. And dying of cancer really, really stinks. It's messy, undignified. I mean, I'm sorry if anyone listening kind of feels that that's not their experience. This was my experience of, although they made it as good as it could be. I mean, it is interesting that there at that age there was no support for children.
Well, it was barely any in 1988, so I can imagine in 1988 there was not much going on at all. I mean, it's so different now. People still struggle to get access, but there's literally charities just to help children, which like blew my mind.
They're wonderful. So it was difficult because my sister was one, and Mum was going to and fro. And I actually remember I kind of didn't want to go anymore. And I don't know whether I didn't want to go because I wanted to stay, and I don't know. rearrange my Body Shop
things
in my bedroom or kind of do a doodle about how much I fancied Tom Griggs or what. But I didn't seem to... I remember my mother saying, you need to come and see your father today, because if you don't, you may regret it. And I remember then being with him, and he, because the cancer had spread to his brain, he wasn't lucid.
Yeah.
And most of the hair had gone from his head, and what the kind of the progression of melanoma on is quite sort of vivid, you might say, baroque almost, actually. He had fantasies that there was kind of some sort of detective plot, and someone called Dr. Tutankhamun who was coming. And so it was always, I remember kind of actually our family were able to discuss that this was quite funny, or he would have found it quite funny. And I was desperate all the time when he was nursed at home. He was in bed on the ground floor, for him to say, I love you and goodbye, but he didn't.
God, so it's so weird, because that's what happened to me. I don't know if I've said this in the show, so we were going to the hospice. Well, we weren't, I always say hospice, it was a hospital. He was at a cancer hospital. He was too sick to be moved. And it became to me, it probably was only about 5 days, but it, in my head, felt like a routine.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? I've been Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I don't want to go today. It's Friday. I want a day off. And I said to my mum, I'm not going today. And she said, you have to. And I was like, why? Why can't I have to sit here, watch telly, and just not have to deal with it today?
The CFAX.
Yes, yeah, I love the CFAX. They made me laugh about the CFAX. I remember her saying, like, sitting in the living room being like, you kind of have to go today.
Yeah.
And me still kind of not quite getting it, but being like, okay, well, I'm not going to cause a fuss because dad's really ill, so I'm not going to, like, kick off and be like, I'm not fucking going. But she's been a bit weird. Like, just... How can you? Just like, you're too young to understand what someone's trying to tell you. They're trying to tell you they're dying, but you don't know what that means.
I can't remember. It sounds like I can't remember whether it was just I was bored.
Yeah.
Or whether something in me thought, this is too much, which would be fair.
Yeah.
In both our cases, that this is actually too much for me.
I remember thinking I just wanted a day off, but I didn't think... Like, now I can put into words like, oh, I was tired or I was emotional. But at the time, if you'd asked me, I'd be like, I just want a day off.
Yeah.
That's all I felt. Because it was like, what I meant was like, this is relentless and he looks awful and I'm...
And it's
everyone's
boring.
It's boring. And everyone's dying around him and it's sort of horrible as well. You know, your instinct as a child, especially, is like, well, this is not a nice place. Like, even though, same, the hospital was lovely and he had his own room and there was a little garden and, you know, it was... But it was attached to a sort of decaying Victorian hospital, so... You know, memories of going to the cafe with my brother were just like, and eating disgusting food. And yeah, you know, it's just like, it's not Brent Cross. It's not like, oh, I'm having fun and hanging out with my friends. You're just...
But maybe the sense of unfairness is kicking.
Yeah. So he was in the hospice.
Yeah. And so I did go in, and for some reason, maybe mum needed to go and take my sister for a walk or something, but I was left alone with him. And I remember feeding him a tiny bit of ice cream, and there was those little pink sponges on sticks.
Yes, oh, and my God, because they dry their lips.
Yeah, and I gave him that, and I fed him some ice cream, and I said, I love you. And then the next day, the next morning, I probably, you know, it's possible I've missed a day here, but in my memory, that was the last time I saw him alive. And then I was asleep. And then the phone rang, and I woke to the phone ringing and hearing my mother cry.
Oh, God. So hard, isn't it?
It's funny, because I was on my way here, I thought, I could talk about grief, but I don't feel anything. It's
like, I'm fine.
Yeah, I just thought, oh, this is going to be a conversation lacking in emotion, completely arid.
Yeah.
Sort of, I've rehearsed this story too many times for it to have any. I mean, but it's actually, yeah, it still feels very, very raw. And that's 19. So where are we? 2019. Yeah, so that's 31 years ago. And that's.
I know.
That's bizarre.
It's really bizarre. I sometimes wonder if it is something to do with losing a parent young. like, obviously I only have my experience, so I don't know, like, if you lost your parent at, like, you know, 35, and then 30 years on, you're 65, perhaps you don't feel the same rawness. I don't know. Email me in and tell me, as you, I'm sure you people will. But I feel like you. I can sometimes be like, yeah, I'm fine to talk about it. And then you're describing something and suddenly you're like, oh, the pain is there. But I can't help but wonder if it comes from not processing something properly at the time because you don't understand it. So it's always a little bit raw because the memory is always a little bit of like, I don't really know what's happening. All I know is I'm very, very sad. Whereas I guess when you're 35, you're like, my father has died. I'm very sad. Life has ended. Whereas when you're 13 and 15, you're like, I just feel sad and I can't really put into words what, like, quite what's happening to me.
I don't know. I think nothing is comparable.
Yeah,
and I
certainly
know watching my husband, whose father died at 84, I'm going to get the age wrong, but and his mother earlier, and that the grief is raw and real. There may be more of an opportunity for adult processing. I can't speak for it because I've not experienced it. But I totally
agree. I think it can't compare, but I wonder sometimes, like, do you know what I mean? Like, if you're older, then when it's 30 years on, you're in your 60s. And that's a different, but I think for us, because you're always frozen in a time when you didn't have the words for something.
Yes. Didn't have the words, didn't have any, and you're trying to juggle or deal with so many other things. And I think it was just a very long process of complete denial. I was told that I was a grown-up now.
Oh, fun.
by the au pair who was looking after, helping to look after my sister. And she meant it. Kind of, she said, you must be brave. You must be a grown-up now.
Oh, God.
And I think a lot of people might have said that to me at the time. And that freezing from processing, which is, I feel you experienced too.
Yeah.
And not wanting to bore anyone, and other people, one's peers, obviously
just in a different party. They're in a different room of the party, aren't they?
Yeah, like, and they're not in any way able. A fellow 13-year-old isn't that equipped. I mean, my best mate was amazing, but they don't have the vocabulary.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You don't have the vocabulary. They don't have the vocabulary. Yeah. And so you reach this point of, like you said, where you don't, well, I didn't really talk about it. I might say, oh yeah, he's died. And I'm, oh yeah, it's sad. But I would often parrot phrases, which I thought sounded good.
Like, what did you say?
I'd say things like, it was really good, it was really fast. Like, he would have really hated to have a long illness.
Oh, that's
good, doesn't it? Sounds good,
smooth,
doesn't it?
That's smooth.
Because people kept saying it. People, like, his friends kept saying it. So I thought, yeah. Like, it's really, you know, obviously it's sad, but it's great he wasn't ill for so long. He would have hated that. It sounds like I know what I'm talking about, but really what I want to say was like, ow, what's happened? I don't understand. Why do people die?
That's really interesting, the discourse of positivity that has come about. I wanted to kind of, as your career as a comedian has come across it, kind of look at on the bright side, almost immediately.
Yeah. But that's very much like...
It sounds like kind of, it was bonus.
Sort of like something to say. I think the thing is, when somebody dies young and they've got kids... And the kids are young.
Yeah.
People just, there's nothing to say. So they're trying to find something. Mm. So they're like, well, you know, he would have hated to be ill. And all these things that they're just trying, because what no one wants to say is, this is what I think when I hear people say that. It's like, this is awful. It will affect those children for the rest of their lives.
It's absolutely.
And I feel like people don't say that enough of like, well, she's 13. She's not a grown-up, but her life has irrevocably changed and she will spend the rest of her life dealing with this. Yeah. No one wants to say that around.
My best friend's dad, who, amazing bloke, his mother died when he was, I think, 7 or 8, very suddenly. And he was the person who picked up my mum, my brother, my baby sister and me from the hospice, because she drove there and realised she couldn't drive back, not surprisingly.
Yeah.
And then at the funeral, I mean, God's sake, we had the wake in our house. I mean, how do you, you're meant to be catering? but I was sort of preoccupied by kind of what I was going to wear. And then there was this sort of receiving line as people left. Mm. And he bent down and he said, I wish... I could tell you it's going to be all right, but it's not. And then he kind of just started to cry. And that was really helpful.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Because someone's witnessing what you're feeling as opposed to telling you, it's fine, you're going to be okay, you'll be strong, which isn't how you feel.
I think I wasn't feeling anything
at that point.
But I think what it did was it just became, when I realised along the way, as the kind of the changing nature of grief, that this doesn't feel all right. This actually really still feels completely blown to pieces. Oh, no, it still doesn't. And even now, so I imagine that Colin, at that point when he bent down in the hall, was probably around the age I am now, it's not all right. Mm. It's not all right that this happened. Mm. And just a kind of confirmation.
Yeah. But again, I'm really glad he said that to you, because I think a lot of people would have... Don't upset them. Don't say anything to the children. Just say, I'm so sorry, and chin up and all of that stuff. Chin up. People said it to my mum, and I remember thinking, what the fuck does that mean? What does it actually mean? But I think I'm really glad that he spoke to you as... I mean, it's like an adult, but really it's a fellow griever, isn't it? This is really shit. This is shit, girl. Sorry. Mm. I'm real sorry. Like, it's nice to have that.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So you went to the funeral, and then how long did you feel, this is a stupid question, but like, how long did you feel numb for? Can you remember when it started like eking out?
I don't know whether I...
Are you still in the numb bit? I think
actually started writing it down.
Oh, wow.
Around time, sort of when I was about 38, starting to think about it, that was helpful because I think I did a lot of things to stop.
Thinking, I mean, you talk about some of them in the book because, it's sort of, we should say, it's sort of part memoir and part in a very interesting discussion on Anna Karenina and part about grief and lot. So it covers a lot of stuff, but the lengths you went to sort of not think about it are definitely covered.
Yeah. I think seeing my father's body was very helpful for realising this was real.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful that happened.
Well, they say that now. That is like one of the biggest problems one of the biggest things they say for kids is they should see the body. Yeah.
And I think, as far as I was allowed to go in alone.
Mm.
I do think that grief in a family is so distinct. Mm. Everyone is mourning a different person. Certainly I was mourning a different person to my mother was mourning a husband. I was mourning a father. And that's a completely different thing to be losing. I think until I acknowledged that I was a child when I lost my father and not an adult.
Yeah.
But because I'd been told I was an adult.
Yeah.
And I realised that just randomly. I read something about... a writer said something about Wordsworth, who said he was a bereaved child, It was written, that was written by a psychologist, and they said, and some of the effects of bereavement on children are risk-taking behaviour, promiscuity, drugs, alcohol. I mean, I didn't have a problem with either of those two, but I was very risk-taking and I was a very promiscuous teenager. And I'd never put those together.
Oh, wow.
And once I started to see a narrative that I hadn't. I mean, it could have been. I just kind of, maybe I would have been that way anyway. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe I'm now trying to kind of put an intriguing psychological spin to just the fact that I like to live it up. But I do think I lived quite strangely in terms of absolutely numbly pouring myself into academic work at school. I have all my diaries say, "Dear Father God / Daddy." So I basically used to have this strange sort of figure who was both. I sort of conceived of another realm because I couldn't quite conceive that he was gone. So I had to hold on to this idea that I could talk to him in the sky. And then I just basically said, I'm going to get an A in this. I'm going to make you proud. And it was all this, I suppose, in the stages of grief that I was just... Maybe you can't sustain that sense of being good all the time. And then I just used to go and sort of take extraordinary risks and then come back and be very good at school again.
Yeah, I think you say that in the book. I think it's incredible the double life that you started leading of, like, everything at school being... wonderful. I definitely didn't, like, I wasn't an A grade student at all. Like, I sort of, what's the word? Like, slipstreamed by, I guess. Like, because I was okay enough, I would never have let my work slip to the point that someone would have had to speak to me. So I knew to do enough, but it was like what's the bare minimum I have to do to make sure everyone leaves me alone? So I would have felt if I'd been if I'd been getting A's or something, as if, you know, I could have done it if I wanted to. No, I couldn't have. But I think I would have felt like, oh, well, that's attention. People might start asking questions. Like, I kind of wanted to slip under the radar. So just don't speak to me about it. I was just terrified somebody would ask me an actual direct question about it, and then I would break down and I wouldn't be able to stop. And then the risk taking is interesting because I think my brother might have gone down that road, but I really didn't. I really didn't. I went the complete, like, and I read that about child bereavement, and I always feel like, oh, why didn't I get the fun stuff? I didn't get to go partying. I got the absolute, people can die, so just don't do anything.
Okay.
Shut it down. It's not safe. The world is not. And my friends, because I was 15, so my friends started taking drugs, and I was just the person holding their head back and calling their mum, being like, you need to come here, we're here, she's taken this and she's drunk this. Because it was just, like, terrifying to me. I was like, you might die. Why would you do, you're going to die? Like, we're all going to die. Stop everyone trying to die. Like, it felt like dancing with it.
I think I felt that I had to cram in as much experience as possible.
Which I admire. I really admire that.
and still do.
Yeah. But then I wonder if that's why I perform as well. Because I do something that... But that to me doesn't seem risky
risky. Yeah, but it is risky. You're putting yourself out there on stage. And improv, I mean, really. You couldn't... Surely that's the sort of...
I think it is.
Extreme.
That's, well, it's a very safe way. If you think about it, it's like... It's definitely a way that you're not going to... You might die. You might be... you might have a bad gig, you might bomb, you might be humiliated, but I felt like I wasn't taking something like a chemical drug that could kill me. So it's like a way of taking risk in a safe, to me feels really safe, because it's like, oh, then what's the worst that's going to happen? I have a bad gig. Like, when my friends were taking drugs, I was like, there's someone, a girl in the paper took a drug and then she died, guys. Like, no one literally physically drops dead at an improv gig.
I know, but it is a it's a self-exposure.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like where we began talking about writing as a kind of element of hedonism risk. I do think it's really, it's interesting that the sort of appetite for experience that comes with drama and the staging of it. And I think there's a critic who says that people who go on stage are dying before our eyes. And it's just that you are alive in body and you are vulnerable.
Yeah, definitely. I can see that. But the kind of, I suppose I felt like I had to do it with the safety net.
Yeah.
So, like, with improv, you know, you have the safety net, as I can do all these have these experiences, but I then walk off and I'm okay. And...
Well, I'd stick with that. I really, really, and you're not missing out, honestly. You don't want to do my kind of seedy behind the skin Covent Garden activity.
Some of the things, because we're North London girls and you were talking about picking up people on the Northern Line, I was like, who are these men on the Northern Line picking up this teenage girl? I was like, and I used to get the Northern Line as a schoolgirl. And I was like, oh, Sophie, they must have been such grim men. I felt for you. I really did. Because I was like, it's not a nice bit sometimes. That sort of bit, as you come out the tunnel, you get some very salubrious people. But you write about it absolutely beautifully. And I think that's really interesting what you said about, that was a big realisation for me, that 15 was young.
Okay,
because for years I thought it wasn't. I was like, well, it's 15.
It's practically 18.
It's practically 18. It's practically 20. Like, yeah. I just thought it was quite old. And because at 15 I would have said, you know, I felt like someone, like, I kind of know everything. So that feeds into like, yeah, I've seen life, I get it. Mm. And I don't think it, yeah, I think you have to get quite far away from that age. And then you, like, now if I see a 15-year-old, obviously they look like a child to me. But when you're 20, you're like, oh, they're only 5 years younger. And then you get to 25. And I think as I neared 30, I was like, oh, I was really young when that happened, wasn't I? Which allows you to sort of forgive yourself for a lot of stuff. Because I think I felt guilty for a lot of things and not behaving the right way or reacting the right way. And so I would sort of push that down. And then the further I got away from 15, the more I was able to have perspective and go, oh, you don't have to feel bad about, like, not talking to him properly. Like, you were 15.
Did you feel that you should have been responsible for staging a better conversation?
Yeah, I do. And then I went through the...
I didn't mean to impose that you should have done, but I was just thinking about the amount of responsibility I felt.
I felt like... And then I don't know if you had this, I then felt really pissed off that he didn't do it.
Yes, no, I...
Because I felt, why am I feeling guilty? Once you realise you weren't the adult, you're like, well, why was it my fucking responsibility to have a chat?
Yeah. No, I struggled for many, many years with feeling very angry with him, or let down rather than angry that he didn't have a conversation with me, that he didn't write a letter for every birthday of my future
those
life.
People have letters.
That he didn't create a memory box for me. Why did he not do this? Why did he not? And I was railing against this because when I was talking to my husband, and somehow we're sort of in the conversation and being able to talk to him about it. He said, I wonder whether it was just because he loved you so much, he was refusing to die. He really didn't. Just because the doctors say it's going to happen, it doesn't mean that someone believes going to happen. And I thought that was, and that was a very helpful way. It's been a helpful way for me to frame it, that he was fighting to the absolute last for some sort of...
Well, that would make sense when you have a child the year before.
Yeah.
That would make sense that you're thinking, no, I'm going to be here, I'm going to be here, and I'm going to carry on making this family and being a father of this family. I'm not going anywhere.
But I think probably on top of that, even though he rationally knew it, emotionally, so I'm 43 now, 2 years younger than he was when he died, I can see that I'm still a child as well as an adult. He couldn't emotionally do it. He couldn't generate that conversation. And so I have to just sort of put together all the other acts of love and know that, he would have. And then I look and think, would that box have made it better?
No.
I don't know. And I wonder about those, the letters one writes to. And I was thinking, how could he have written to my future self without imprisoning me?
Yeah, that's true, actually.
I wonder, kind of, because his wishes for me, kind of, what he probably would have... He would have said, Sophie, don't write a brave and exposing memoir about yourself.
Yes.
Or, Sophie, don't do this. Maybe his wishes for me would have not been who I have become, because as you grow with someone, you understand the birthday card that they might want to receive. Projecting into your child's future.
I think
you could get horribly wrong.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. And I have exactly what you have when I see, especially nowadays, because people are much more aware of leaving memories. Mm. And, you know, I watched Queer Eye the other day, and a wife had died and they were making over the husband, but the wife had, like, recorded a storybook for the kids and stuff. And I, you know, you still get the, I don't have that. I don't have his voice. And she'd done birthday cards for all the birthdays. And And, you know, you get that like, oh, in the 80s and 90s, people didn't do those things. But then I think you're right that anything he would have written would have been very strange and actually quite pretty. Well, and I'm sure, some, you know, if you have it, great. If it's helping you, brilliant. But I do know what you mean of like what person are they talking to? Because you'd be talking to a child and you're not that person. And yeah, imprisoning is an interesting turn of phrase for it.
Hmm.
I mean, you just have to find your way through it, however you do. And I've had the same thing of like, I have lots of conversations that I can make up in my head, like as in I can put them all together and I can know what he kind of would have said. And my therapist said this to me the other day, which actually broke me in pieces. I haven't had his voice. And you talk about this for years and years about, you know, you lose someone's voice. And you said you found the dictator, which I also found when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And it broke me then. And I think that's why I don't know where it is. It got lost and it's gone. And I think because it's a painful object, nobody's like, hey, don't throw away that dictator with their voice because like, it's painful. And I feel very sad that I can't really remember what he sounded like. And my therapist said to me, she was like, you can't remember what he sounded like, but you have an innate sense of what he would have said. So the loss is changed into something else in that, yes, you don't have a press play and he's saying, hello, Carriad, I love you. But if you were to say, would he have said you love you? You can press play inside and go, yeah, I know he would.
Oh, God, you got me.
I know. She got me. She said it to me and I was like, huh? So I was like, oh.
Yeah.
And she was like, you know, losses can evolve and change. And I think when you lose someone quite young, it's quite hard because you freeze in that moment and you try and cling to everything in that moment because to lock it down in your memory somehow. And I think, I found it really comforting because I was like, oh, I do have an innate sense of what he would have said about all the things I've done. Like I could write that letter. I know what he would say. And really that's all a parent can do, isn't it? Is like make that love and that bond so strong that when they're not there, you can still think, oh, I know what they would have said at this moment and it would have been nice.
Because listening to you, I was thinking, and obviously hugely selfishly, because I was listening to you thinking, I don't know what he would have said.
Oh,
and then you said, I love you. I thought, yeah, I can probably guarantee he would have said that. I don't know much else. I can't remember anything, sadly. I mean, I know that if I'd asked him how a carburetor works, he would have told me in blow by blow detail, but I don't know kind of emotionally what he would have said. But you did that. Thank you for that gift, because I think I can project that into each birthday reliably.
Yeah, and I feel the same. Like, I don't know what he would have said in detail, but I know that he was very proud of things. He'd be very like, oh, look at this, look what they've done.
Yes.
So I know that. Like, I have no idea what he would have thought about me doing a very exposing podcast where I talk about him all the time. But I know he would have been, I think he would have been proud, you know, I know he would have been proud of it. So
yeah.
Same thing, I don't have like the detail, but it's that feeling, isn't it? It's that feeling of like, that you were loved, that they loved you. And I think it's hard because that's all you've got, isn't it? That's all you've got. Like, everything else is so shifting.
Yeah.
The memories are so shifting and did you have this, like, once you've written about stuff, it almost goes out your brain into somewhere else?
I don't know, but I was caught by what you just said, it's all you've got, because among kind of in some ways among the sort of impetuses for writing a book about bereavement was my husband was kind of very curious about my father and said, kind of, I mentioned something, he said, oh, have you got that? And I go, no. And then later on he said, oh, have you still got that? I was like, no. And then I said, could you stop asking whether I've got things that belong to my father? Because by various circumstances, to do with lots of house moves, lots of things, I don't have anything or very little. So could you stop it, please? Because
it's
really,
really
upsetting.
Yeah.
Like, if anything I mentioned, I don't have. And then, so I was thinking, well, what does this stuff mean? And it was interesting, before I came down here, I was thinking about the diary entry. I've got the diary, which is busy talking about all this sort of teenage kind of piano and shall I shave my legs? And and then there is a page, and I've written, on 18th of September 1988, he died today. Why? And then that's it. And I thought, maybe I'll bring that. And I was looking through the box, I couldn't find it. And the thing is, I'm quite careless. I know it will turn up again.
Yeah.
And I did find something else of his that I had been looking for. And I thought, why does it matter so much for me, all these bits and pieces, and it's almost to sort of prove that happened. But I thought, Kara's not going to think I made it up. Kind of coming up with my documentary evidence.
Yeah, is,
but,
yeah.
But I was just interested in what are you going to, you said, what have you got? Mm. And I was wondering, the it's interesting relationship between grief and objects and the things we keep. And and do they make a difference?
Well, you write about that really beautifully about loss and how you are someone who loses things almost as in a proof of like, well, it's just another, I lost my dad, I lost my keys, I lost this. And again, I think I've gone the other way of like, I don't lose stuff.
You don't lose stuff.
I know I am so tight with my stuff. Like, as in, like, it's like, when you were writing, I understood your point of view, but I was like, oh, I've gone the other way where like everything, if it's not in the place where I put like last left it, someone's stolen it. Like, I am so freaking careful with things because I can't bear losing an umbrella. Like, it is too painful.
Yeah.
So when someone said to me once, they were like, oh, I just, you know, buy an umbrella every month. And I was like, the umbrella. But that's your umbrella. Like, why aren't you fighting to keep the umbrella?
Yeah.
Like, the umbrella becomes my dad. Like, and so I've had to get better at losing things because I had a child and my memory got dodgy and, you know, you get, there's more shit around and you're like, oh, I don't know what that is now. But I find any loss of an object so painful. So painful. So, but that's not to say like I have absolutely lost things, but it's like there's still a list in my head, like Aya Stark, where I'm like, these are the things that have been taken from me.
It's interesting. So I do find losing things painful and I'm almost resigned to it. And I'm not careless on purpose.
Yeah. I must
be subconsciously very careless on purpose.
Yeah.
It's almost like I have to keep on. Either I am just crap or I just have to keep on processing this element of discarding.
That's why I think it's interesting.
Like, stuff doesn't matter. I promise. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that you lose stuff. It just because, if as long as I've got me, that's all right. But then occasionally, I mean, people matter.
Yeah.
But I think I still probably try to be quite ambivalent about losing stuff.
But
otherwise, it's acknowledging that these things I should have had all the other ones.
And I think it's just the same side of the many faced coin of like, I have decided I can't be ambivalent about it. So like my reaction to the death is like, will you hold on to things till your nails are bleeding? And I would say the way that's affected me, like I am loyal to the point of ridiculousness sometimes. Like I've had to sometimes acknowledge and go, I'm so bad at letting things go. I'm so bad at saying goodbye to people. Like I just can't, like even if just like a casual friend pops on for tea, I'm like, and they start to go, I start feeling, I'm going to have to say goodbye. I'm going to say goodbye. Like I find that difficult. So I've gone down that road of like every single loss is painful. And I think what you're doing is very, and again, of course it's not carelessness, it's like self-protection.
Yes.
It's like, it's fine, I don't need it. Whereas I'm like, don't go!
And I think it was, that's one of the things I was trying to sort of get my head around. And it's sort of difficult to talk about this without saying, make it sound facile or making myself sound like a really nasty person. So with hedging, I wondered whether the experience of grief has made me quite hard. Careless with people. And difficulty forming relationships or keeping people or throwing them.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that to sound. And does this sort of knock onto a sort of maternal ambivalence or a resistance or not? I mean, it's much more complicated than that little summary.
I am
interested in the hardening effect of grief.
Yeah.
And I think it's, and I hope it doesn't make me truly heartless because I think quite hard about it. But I think it is interesting, and I enjoyed actually trying to think about it a bit more.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. I don't think, and I think that's why grief is such a fascinating subject for everybody because the myriad effects of it are so minor and major at exactly the same time that it can feel like a lot of clashing notes occasionally.
Yeah.
And I've definitely, I hardened, but in completely different ways. So it's, but I completely understand there's definitely, I have no tolerance for people, but I won't lose you. But I have no tolerance for you and your bullshit and your faff and your mistake because it's like, all I care is that you haven't left me and you haven't died. Like, so I like, So it's like it's just different. But I completely understand you're like, well, I don't need you because people die. That's what they do. Whereas I'm like, oh, I need you. You need to stay near me. But I will. Yeah. I will be hard to your emotions because emotions might bring up my emotions and make me feel vulnerable. So I think it's just. And I think, again, I'm sure when you're bereaved as an adult, obviously all this stuff does happen. But I think when you're bereaved as a teenager, especially, lots of little decisions are being made about who you are and what you're going to do and how you're going to react to the world. And then, like, this smashes in to what you're trying to think of who you are. And, you know, like any trauma, it just ruptures a lot of things. So then the way you relate to people, the way you feel about the world, all of these things are deeply, deeply affected. Why wouldn't they be? But it takes a long time, I think, to kind of look back at yourself and go, oh, I see, that's why I do that. Like, it took me years to work out the goodbye thing. I just thought I just wasn't very good at goodbyes. Just a bit shit at them. Now I'm like, I honestly act like people are like, it's the last goodbye. Like, I'm saying goodbye. Like,
I'm looking forward to saying goodbye. Yeah, it's great because I've got quite a lot of spare time. Yeah, so we can go down the
pub. I am so bad. I keep people for so long because honestly, I am acting like this is it. So it's always very dramatic. But then, and you're right, though, you then come back round as an early griefer of like, well, is that just bullshit? And is that, like, would I have been like that anyway? Mm. But I don't think that's true. I think you can see where the sort of earthquake of grief has ruptured the rocks of you.
Yeah.
Which is one of my worst metaphors.
No, it's nice. We'll work it. Yeah. I was kind of in this terrain. I was I go to have an annual check because I've had skin cancer. The same.
You've had it as well?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So I had almost the same age he was diagnosed with.
Wow.
Skin cancer. I was diagnosed with a very early stage melanoma. So that's why I've got a scar on my arm there.
Oh, one, yeah, on there. Yeah.
And one there.
Oh my God.
And so they took it out. It was very, very early stage, but I really like my scars because they remind me of him. It's almost like his loss of life gave me mine because I was much more aware of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was at the checkup and I was sitting there and in my worried well state, I'd left and he said, it's all fine. I've checked your moles, they're all fine. And then I thought, maybe I didn't ask him for that one. And then I'll have to go back in and that would be really embarrassing. And, oh God, shall I go in? Shall I go? And I thought, I won't go in. But now I'm dead. Now I'm dead. It's all right. Because my usual, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
And then I thought, oh God, it does matter. Because I've got two little children.
Mm.
And I thought, it'll be all right. I thought, no, it won't be all right.
Mm.
And I think that's the kind of the sort of limits of ambivalence about loss hit there. I sort of thinking from the other side, I just thought, no, that won't be all right. Anyway, I probably did. It's all right. I went for another checkup. I'm still all right. But I do, yeah, I hate going for those checkups because it's one of those moments in life when I think, no, if it's not all right, I can't be square with this one.
Well, it's like we said, like you have the knowledge, like your friend's dad did, of like, oh, this will affect them for the rest of their lives. Like, you can't be like, and again, and I always say this to people because I feel like sometimes when you're still banging on about something, you know, 20 years on, sometimes I feel like people are like, oh God, like she, like her dad died and like really fucked her up. And like, it's kind of all she talks about. And you're like, oh no, I'm okay. Mm. But that still exists. And both of those things, like we talked about, winning, exist at the same time. Like, it's just a part of it, isn't it? It's just a part of who you are.
And I think there are, I don't know whether you agree, but there are gifts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I must read this bit. I wanted to read this. Do you want to read it?
I'm very happy if you want to read it.
Okay. So it's just, it's quite long, but this is the about gaining something, which I thought was really good. The true sadness of grief is mixed up with feelings that you are never sad enough, that you are doing it wrongly, or selfishly, or theatrically. And it's far beneath any arrangements of words on a page. It feels as if someone is scraping a grapefruit spoon on the inside of your stomach. I talked to a friend who is a psychologist. She says that we sometimes try to tell too neat a story about what loss can do. We sit in the bright white of her kitchen and she makes me coffee. She asks some questions and listens. Before I leave, she goes up to her study and brings down a book. Sometimes, she says, the experience of losing a parent can be processed as much as a gain as a loss. Intuitively, that makes no sense. You think that when you have lost something, you would be sad, empty, bereft, hollowed out. Actually, it can be that and something else too. She opens a book to show me. There's a chapter about the way in which utter devastation, particularly that of losing a parent, can lead some people to feel almost elated, like they've survived a bomb. The near miss makes them feel as if nothing can touch them again. Of course, the writer says, losing a parent is not like having a house bombed or being set upon by a crazed mob. It's worse. It's not over in one terrible moment, and the injuries do not heal as quickly as a bruise or a wound. But like a bomb, he writes, parental death can feel like a kind of near miss. It can, for some, give the sense that a bomb has dropped just beside you. The death of a parent can be a kind of gift to a certain sort of child. The fact of survival leaves you feeling tough, exhilarated, hardened by experience. I know this. The worst thing has happened, and we are still standing. I love that, Sophie. I absolutely love that. Sorry to read your book at
you.
No,
it was really... I wrote it to be...
To be read,
to echo or to speak out to other people.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, it's a huge honour to hear you read
it. Oh, bless you.
Because I felt you got it.
But when I read that, I was like, I felt like... you know, when someone's saying something like a guilty sin, you're like, yeah, I know that. Why are you don't you, Sophie, you're telling everyone that we feel good about it sometimes.
Yes.
Like, I was like, oh. Yeah, because then I think I'm a definite testament to that form of survival, and that it sort of gives you a weird power and a weird strength.
I do think it is very interesting, and it's among what I wanted to do in this book was to talk about things we hide from other people, and among them we hide our grief, but we may also hide more taboo things about grief, like its theatricality, the fact it can be performed in a way that stinks and has real bad faith, and that there can be ways in which it can give you a strange sort of charge. I mean, partly because the worst thing has happened and you've survived it, but it's peculiar.
Sophie, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about your dad, Andrew, and your wonderful book as well, The Lost Properties of Love.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You can follow Sophie on Twitter at SoRatCli. So SoRatCli. Had to think about that. And her book, The Lost Properties of Love, is available to buy now, and I cannot recommend it enough. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whittledown Studios, and the music is provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.